Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. Very soon, we'll hear from Keith Gessen, the novelist and N+1 editor, about his recent trip to Kiev. And then we'll hear from the political scientist Martin Gillens, who has statistical proof that the rich rule and the median voter counts for squat. On to the writer and editor Keith Gessen. Gessen published a novel, All the Sad Young Literary Men, in 2008. He is one of the founding editors of the literary political journal N+1 4 years earlier. It is very difficult to understand what's been going on in Ukraine. According to the Russians, it's all just a fascist coup. To enthusiasts, it was all a glorious, spontaneous uprising. A piece in the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago quoted a Ukrainian TV pundit as saying this: all of the oligarchs were financing the protests. European association suits them well as it expands the metallurgical quota for Pinchuk and Akhmatov, two oligarchs, that is, both of whom have already done so much to legalize their capital in the West. Legalizing their capital suggests a certain cloud of illegitimacy. Anyway, here is Keith Gessen, recently back from a visit to Kiev, to offer his view. Welcome, Keith. You were recently in Kiev. When were you there, and what did it look like to you?
I was there from mid-March to late March. It looked amazing. There are about 50 military tents set up still on the Maidan, still with people living in them. They've occupied about 10 buildings next to Maidan. In a way, it was very inspiring. At the same time, it was really depressing because they had this revolution. They forced a pretty nasty tyrant to leave. And just as they were beginning to sort of work things out internally, the Russians showed up and seized part of their country and are threatening to seize more.
You were born in Russia, right?
Yes.
Spent how long there?
I was there till I was 6 years old.
Do you feel any Russian loyalties in any of this?
I do, to an extent. One of the big, most contentious issues in Ukraine between the Russian-speaking population and the more pro-Ukrainian population is a language issue. So the Ukrainians want the Russians and everyone else to speak Ukrainian because they live in Ukraine. And a certain number of the Russians don't want to learn Ukrainian. They say, we were born in the Soviet Union. We grew up speaking Russian. We didn't go anywhere. We're still right where we were when we were born. We were born in Odessa or Donetsk or Kharkiv. Why should we suddenly have to learn a new language? And as a Russian speaker and a non-Ukrainian speaker, I have a certain amount of sympathy for that.
The languages are fairly similar, right?
They are fairly similar, and in a way, it makes it almost more vexed than it would otherwise be, because there's something like 90% syntactic overlap, but they're still mutually incomprehensible. If you don't know Ukrainian, then you can't really understand it if you're a Russian speaker. You know, from the Ukrainian point of view, if you're a Russian who refuses to learn Ukrainian, you really have no respect. Unlike a place like Kazakhstan or Estonia, where the languages are so far apart that it would require a real effort on the part of a Russian speaker to learn them.
But even here, 20 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, 20 plus years, the populations are still awfully mixed up, right? It's not easy to make to map nation onto state.
Certainly. Just about everyone speaks Russian, for example. There's a lot of mixed marriages. You talk to people, they say, my mother's Ukrainian, my father's Russian. I think 30 or 40 years ago, people didn't even really think in those terms, Russian-Ukrainian. Yes, you know, there, certainly in the West, you know, if you go to Lviv, you will hear on the streets, everyone speaking Ukrainian on the streets, and you'll have trouble getting people to answer you in Russian. And then you go further east, you go to Donetsk, where they've just seized the Secret Service building in Donetsk, the Russian separatists have. And there everybody is speaking Russian. So if you go, you know, if you go east to west or west to east, you do see the language change.
What would you say about the makeup of the people who are protesting in the Maidan?
That's a tough question. It was a large group, and it had all sorts of people in it. It was basically a coalition of Kiev liberals and right-wing groups, mostly from the west of the country. You have two major right-wing groups, the Svoboda, which is a political party, and the Right Sector, which is a kind of agglomeration of various smaller right-wing groups. During the actual protests, especially during the violent confrontations, these right-wing groups took a leading role in the confrontations with police. When you had, 100,000 people, 500,000 people out there, then naturally they became a smaller part of the protest movement. It's definitely a nationalist protest movement. They are speaking mostly from the point of view of wanting to have an independent Ukraine, a Ukraine that is moving toward Europe and away from Russia, but I think the away from Russia is an important aspect of it.
Yeah, I remember seeing, this is many months ago now, but there's some people protesting in Kiev who had the EU logo painted on their faces, and I thought to myself, who the hell would do that? But what does the EU mean? Is it a way just to get away from Russian influence, or is it some aspiration to join Europe? What does it mean to the people who are protesting?
Well, I mean, one thing to understand about Ukraine is it's really poor. They have not done well in the post-Soviet era. They're, comparatively worse off than they were in 1990. And they had expectations.
Which is true of almost every of the...
Well, it's not true of Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan has a lot of oil, which was found in the late 80s, and Kazakhstan's doing great. You go to Kazakhstan, there's a lot of oil money in Kazakhstan. Belarus is not doing so badly. Ukraine is doing really badly. And Ukraine is a place that actually had expectations. It had a literate population. It had a lot of industry. It had tourist attractions. You might have expected Ukraine to do well. Instead, it's done really badly. So I think Europe for them is just a kind of an aspiration of better material conditions. And a political
aspiration.
People
don't think they'd end up more like Portugal and Germany if they were to join Europe.
I think they think of Italy, Germany, France.
Uh-huh. So they wouldn't end up as, Romania. Poor on an austerity program.
They don't think that, no.
We've gotten a lot of contradictory reports here. It was Occupy Wall Street. It was just the people. It was a bunch of fascists. They're being manipulated. The oligarchs were running everything. Intelligence services were running everything. How do you sort all that out?
I don't know, but when you go there and you talk to the people who are actually still there, and for the most part, the people who are still sitting there are not your kind of liberal urban type people. Those people will have gone back to their jobs mostly. But these people are idealistic. They were fed up with the Yanukovych regime. They were willing to die. And one of the strongest impressions of walking around Maidan is all these photos. That are plastered all over of the people who were killed during the protests. And there's more than 100 of them. They're called the Celestial 100. And when you talk to people, they're constantly referring to the people who died. They say, we need to keep working. We need to keep the pressure on the interim government because otherwise these people will have died in vain. So I feel, no matter what you think ultimately of their politics and, no matter whether the oligarchs bought them military tents for them to sleep in, these were people who were very moved and courageously went out there and risked their lives.
And what was their beef with the previous regime?
I was there in 2010 when Yanukovych was being elected. And this was 5+ years after the Orange Revolution, which had rejected Yanukovych. Because of massive electoral fraud, and elected Viktor Yushchenko, his rival, instead. And in 2010, Yushchenko was a real disappointment. He hadn't delivered on any of his promises. People were very tired of him. He had instigated a lot of historical controversies. He had sort of dug up a lot of painful moments in Ukrainian history as a way to try to instill kind of nationalist Ukrainian values. People were really tired of him. And the country wasn't doing well economically, but it was doing quite well in certain other kind of vectors of free speech, freedom of assembly. You had a free and fair election, and Yanukovych won. And at the time, I don't think anyone really thought that it was going to be so terrible. It seemed like the situation was pretty bad, but it was a stable situation. And Yanukovych really seems to have gone beyond all reasonable bounds, mostly in terms of corruption. But he also, he put his main political rival in prison. which is under the kind of rules of Ukrainian politics, that was not really part of the rules of the game. Power had gone back and forth between the major political parties, and you didn't have anybody going to jail. So this was a kind of violation of the rules of the game, but mostly it was corruption. It was just rampant. His son suddenly was a billionaire, even though he had was trained as a dentist. He was the dentist billionaire. So you had a peaceful protest against his failure to sign the agreement with the EU. The peaceful protest was violently attacked by riot police, and that's when you had a lot of people come out onto the streets.
That rival that could put in jail was the woman with the curious braid, whose name I can't pronounce.
Yulia Tymoshenko, yes.
Yes, and she is not widely loved, is she?
She's not widely loved. She, too, has been accused, and the accusations have stuck, of being highly corrupt. She was in government for many years, and Ukrainians did not benefit from that. So right now, in fact, the front runner for the presidency is a chocolate maker named Poroshenko. He's one of the big oligarchs.
And there's a boxer, too?
Klitschko, the boxer, but he has actually withdrawn from the presidential race and thrown his weight behind Poroshenko.
Then a couple of oligarchs have been appointed governors of the provinces, too, right? So.
That's right. There's a curious article in the Times about how the oligarchs were appointed in order to assure the people that everything is okay.
It's very reassuring.
Yes, it's not clear that the people have been reassured. one of the oligarchs is now in charge of Donetsk. This is where a lot of the unrest is taking place. The richest man in Ukraine, Rinat Akhmetov, was mostly a steel and aluminum baron from Donetsk. He was the kind of power behind Yanukovych. He went out yesterday and met with the protesters and tried to calm them down. It's unclear what sort of game he's playing right now.
All this reminds me of, and these are somewhat disparate phenomena, but, you know, Occupy, in some sense, and the various Arab Springs, in that they're a really heterogeneous group of people who got together, united by discontent and not much else, with no organization and no ideology. And in the case of Occupy, it just fizzled out and business as usual seems to have returned. In the cases of the Arab Springs, a lot of it was just a new set of elites moved in, displacing the old set of elites, or maybe not even so new. It looks like that's what's happened in Ukraine as well. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my first impression of Maidan was, well, this is just like Occupy, but it's an Occupy that won. And that was pretty cool. But it's also the case that, yes, the liberals who are active are still active, but they don't have a visible presence on Maidan. And it does feel like they're somewhat at the mercy of the right-wing groups that are able to mobilize a lot of people to come and stand in front of the Rada and you know, possibly even threaten the Rada with its dispersal. And the right-wing groups do seem better organized. They've the one kind
and
of...
They've got guns.
They have a few guns. I don't know how many guns they have. They have sticks. But, you know, the one kind of people's leader who has emerged from this whole Maidan experience, who did not exist as a political figure before, is a man named Dmitry Yarosh, who's the leader of the right sector. And he's kind of a slippery figure, but he's clearly a nationalist. He's sort of declared war on the Minister of the Interior. He's not a positive figure in Ukrainian politics. You know, it also feels a little bit like they had their February Revolution and they got rid of the bad guy, but there might be other things down the line.
There's no Lenin in their future, though.
Well, you know, if there is, it's someone like Yarosh.
I'm speaking with Keith Gessen, who's a writer and an editor at N Plus One. Let's talk some about Russia. Putin is a widely demonized figure in the United States. Do you share that view of him as an earthly representative of Satan?
Putin's certainly a bad guy. I think the thing to keep in mind, certainly with regard to, for example, Crimea, is that throughout the 1990s, numerous Russian politicians called for Russia to take Crimea back. Mayor Lushkov, the mayor of Moscow, called for this so many times that...
It was given to Ukraine by Khrushchev in a fit of generosity, right?
Yes, in 1954. Although some lands were taken away from Ukraine in exchange. So historically, not really part of Ukraine, and this really rubbed the Russians the wrong way in the 1990s. But Lushkov called for this so many times that the Ukrainian government finally said, you can't come to Ukraine anymore. You're a persona non grata, the mayor of Moscow. And this mayor of Moscow was one of the leading presidential candidates to succeed Yeltsin in the late 90s. Ultimately, he and his partner Primakov were outmaneuvered by the Yeltsin family, and Putin became president. It would be hard to imagine a Russian politician emerging out of the Russian 1990s who didn't have a very strongly nationalist bent and who hadn't, at a certain point, talked about annexing Crimea. Whether they would actually have done it is a different question. Whether they would have done it as skillfully as Putin did it is a separate question, but they certainly would have wanted to. So the idea that Putin is somehow uniquely evil among the Russian political class, that just doesn't really bear up.
People also describe him as a madman and irrational. It seems to me like seizing Crimea, which is the site of an important Russian Navy base, makes perfect rational great power politics sense. It doesn't seem irrational to me. Is that wrong?
I don't know. It depends on what you think the possible consequences are for Russia, whether being isolated diplomatically and somewhat economically, although it's going to be hard to stop using Russian oil and gas, just how damaging that will be. You know, within Russia, people, including my friends on the left, really want the West to come down pretty hard on Russia and punish this sort of behavior. It's also a question, what happens 10 years from now or 15 years from now when Putin is no longer in power? If you imagine a better Russian leader, does he give Crimea back to Ukraine, right? What do you do then? It's certainly a disruptive move.
And you mentioned a Russian left. Surprised that such a thing exists, but how large is it?
There's a small but very vibrant, very active, very courageous Russian left. I mean, all the best young people in Moscow and Petersburg, they are walking around reading Howard Zinn's History of the United States. Yeah, more and more, you go to Moscow and there are these young leftists. I mean, Pussy Riot, in a way, is associated with leftists.
I was disturbed to see Hillary Clinton embracing them the other day, though.
Why disturbed?
Oh, I just don't trust anything Hillary touches.
Oh, yes. So the Russian left, they hate Putin as much as anyone. And they see him, as a representative of large capital. His biggest supporters are the Russian oligarchs. So, you're not going to get a lot of sympathy for Putin from the Russian left, certainly.
It seems that the oligarchs are the ones who are pulling the strings everywhere here. It's like this is just people are at best pawns in the games of oligarchs. Is that too cynical of you?
Well, in Russia, I did just say that they're his biggest supporters, but in Russia, certainly the oligarchs were appointed by the state. They were given these giant companies, basically, by the state in the 1990s. And
one of the things that Putin did was crush the previous generation of oligarchs, right? And
some of them,
his power.
Some of them were removed, but the ones who were willing to play along were kept on, certainly.
But he made no doubt the state was in control.
He made no doubt that the state was in control, and he made it clear that the state could take these companies back, and it did. It took Yukos back from Khodorkovsky when Khodorkovsky became conflictual. So for example, this idea that the elites are going to split over the sanctions and that they're going to rise up against Putin, that the oligarchs are going to rise up against Putin, that strikes me as...
Which is part of the strategy behind the Obama sanction.
Yes, that if you target these people who are near Putin, that they will eventually, stage a palace coup or something. I think they're all aware that they were handed these properties and that these properties can be taken back. So it's unclear what kind of independent room for maneuver those people in particular have. But you have seen people, I think a much kind of more realistic and ethical and moral calculation is to hope that the Russian people eventually grow tired of this. You know, and you did have tens of thousands of people on the streets of Moscow protesting the invasion of Crimea. It's not millions, but it's something.
Does Putin's tough guy stance have resonance with a broad part of the Russian population?
Yes, absolutely. And
a shirtless man who wrestles animals and flies fighter planes and all that.
It is very resonant, unfortunately. I flew back from Kiev through Moscow on Aeroflot. And on the plane, on the flight Moscow to New York, I had a drunk Russian guy sitting next to me throughout the flight. And he turned out to be a computer programmer and an IT entrepreneur who had done very well. And you would think this was a person who would be critical of Putin, maybe. But he was very excited about the seizure of Crimea and Russia really asserting itself on the world stage. Finally, he said, yeah, we're going to lose, as we always lose, but it's going to be really fun.
That's a weird mix of grandiosity and fatalism. Is that just the Russian character at work?
I guess so. But, you know, it's very disappointing. It's really, it's a real bummer that, you know, you feel like the Russians haven't learned a great deal. They haven't changed very much. We're 20-plus years out from the collapse of the Soviet Union.
The first 10 years were truly wretched, though, right after.
Yes, they were terrible, and so they didn't make a very good impression on Russia. And yet, you know, how does a country change? How does the country's sort of political culture change in such a way that they won't support a person like Putin? I don't really know, but it hasn't changed.
We could ask the same about this country.
That's true. And I mean, in fact, you know, the to go back to Ukraine for a second, some of the pro-Russian people that I met with in Odessa, who basically sit around and consume Russian propaganda, really believe it, are very active on Facebook and Russian Facebook, and watch YouTube videos all the time that confirm their beliefs, and can't be talked out of this. They really did remind me of the American right wing, the Tea Partiers, right? The Obama truthers, who, they find what they need in various media, and then they cling to it.
Meaning that it's all a bunch of fascists.
Yes, they have numerous YouTube videos confirming that the protesters on Maidan are out to get them. And unfortunately, the protesters on Maidan.
There's a kernel of truth to that.
There's a kernel of truth, and you know, including you know, in the government, including in the Rada. You know, there's large segments that really don't want to have any, that don't want to make any accommodation to the Russian speaking population, and that's a terrible mistake.
Do you see any civilized resolution to this?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the Russians, especially with the seizure of Crimea, they clearly are really betting on a failed state in Ukraine. It had calmed down for a few weeks, and now over the weekend again we had attacks on the city administration in several cities in eastern Ukraine, probably worse than anything that we've seen up to now. So clearly the Russians are intent on really destabilizing the situation and weakening the Ukrainian state to the point where they have to become a federation and really a kind of a quasi-failed state that can't control its regions.
And they're broken behind in their gas bill.
Yeah, they a lot of problems. The idea that the West is just going to kind of bail them out with money seems deluded. There's not enough money. It's a big country. It's not a tiny little country. There's 40 million people. So that's what the Russians want. You know, it sometimes seems like if the situation were just, if you just had the kind of status quo for long enough, that people would calm down and just go back to doing what they were doing before. The idea that this government is particularly opposed to the Russian population, no more so than the Yushchenko government, which the East and the South tolerated, from 2005 to 2010, and nothing too bad happened then. But it does feel like the Russians are really intent on destabilizing the situation, and it's hard to know what to do.
That was the journalist, novelist, and N+1 editor, Keith Gessen. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after some music. Some of the first movement of Dmitri Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 11, performed by the Sorel Quartet from their marvelous complete run of his quartets. Next, Martin Gillens. Gillens, a professor of political science at Princeton, is co-author of a paper with Benjamin Page of Northwestern on just who influences political decision-making in the USA. You will not be surprised to learn that the rich and business interests exert most of the control, and the average person exerts approximately none. It would be interesting if they extended their analysis to the bottom part of the income distribution, perhaps a task for future research. Many of us have always known about the class contours of political control, but Gillens and Page have numbers to prove it. Martin Gillens. Let's start by set the stage by reviewing some of the classic theories of how policy gets made in the U.S. political system. You open your paper with a review of four principal models. What are these?
There's a surprising degree of diversity in the kinds of forces or social groups that political scientists think influence government policymaking. One of those, the probably most prominent in political science, is ordinary citizens. That might sound sort of, a little like naively optimistic, but in fact there's a lot of evidence that ordinary citizens do shape policy through their impact on elections. And there's a lot of work that shows that policy does tend to coincide with the preferences of ordinary citizens. There's an entirely separate tradition that looks at interest groups. Two versions of that we discussed, one of them being more business-oriented interest groups, which numerically dominate the interest group system in Washington. And there's a lot of work on the sort of nature of those groups and their efforts to lobby policymakers and shape policies in ways that benefit their constituents or their members. There's another variety of that, though, which is a more sort of egalitarian version of the interest group understanding, interest group theory, and that's kind of a majoritarian interest group or interest group pluralism, which suggests that interest groups, in fact, represent a wide range of different social groups and interests and desires, and that those include members of the public, ordinary citizens, as well as sort of specific industries or business groups, and that through these sort of mass-based organizations, through things like unions or the Sierra Club, the National Rifle Association, those kinds of groups, that citizens are able to have a voice in policymaking along with other sorts of organized interests. And then finally, the fourth sort of perspective on government policymaking is economic elites. And the idea here being that basically rich people pull the strings, that they are contributing the money, the bulk of the money at least, in politics, and that's where the real influence lies in shaping government policymaking.
As one walks around Washington and sees all the trade groups in their lavish buildings, it's hard not to believe that they're not seen as dominant forces among professional political scientists.
You know, it's been surprisingly difficult to demonstrate the impact of lobbying by business or others on policy outcomes. And part of the problem is that these groups tend to support representatives in Congress or policymakers more generally who already agree with their values and their priorities. So on the one hand, that is a way of expressing and exerting influence, but on the other hand, it's a very difficult kind of influence to demonstrate empirically, because the sort of, say, votes in Congress don't really appear to change much when some group donates money to a campaign or supports some, you know, subset of a political party, because they're supporting the people who already agree with them. Now, it is, of course, a form of influence because those people got into office and are able to stay in office in part because of that kind of support. And yet it's been a challenge for political scientists to demonstrate in a sort of rigorous manner.
And how do political scientists think about the pretty well-documented contributions from various interest groups and rich folks to particular candidates or causes?
Well, there's an argument about that these kinds of contributions buy access, but not necessarily policy. And it is easy to show, and we've got terrific evidence that shows that those donations do indeed buy access, that representatives and their staff are much more likely to meet with and converse with donors, whether it's lobbyists or rich individuals. Would those people be spending that money if that access didn't translate into policy? Well, it's hard to imagine that they would. They would continue to do that. On the other hand, again, being able to actually demonstrate empirically that that's going on has been very challenging.
And one more question about orthodox political science. That sweet majoritarian story of the civic textbooks, how does that comport with the fact that if we're lucky to get half the potential electorate voting in an election?
Well, that's interesting. You know, the truth is that the people who don't vote, if you ask them their policy views in surveys, tend on the whole to be not all that different from the people that do vote. And so I think the traditions of sort of majoritarian electoral democracy that we discuss in the paper, this notion that individuals shape government policy through elections, is able to say, well, it's true maybe only half the people in presidential elections vote or a third of the people in congressional elections, and yet if their views are reasonably representative of the public as a whole, then this notion is plausible that, you know, office holders need votes to stay in office and that they will shape their policies in order to appeal to the broad public.
That makes elections sound like an opinion poll with a very large sample size.
Well, I think there's something to that, and even my work, which tends to show very little influence among individuals as exerted through elections, is consistent with others in showing that there's, to a degree, a greater responsiveness of government policymakers to the public when elections are imminent. So when there's electoral pressure, policymakers do, to some degree, respond. So I find that in election years, presidential election years in particular, federal government policy does tend to line up more closely with what a sort of broader swath of the public wants to see.
Okay, now moving on to your work. You're working with a new data set. Describe that data set that you and your colleagues have put together.
Sure. So first let me say that the paper that I'm going to be talking about mostly here is co-authored work with a colleague at Northwestern University, Benjamin Page. And the analysis that we've done is a data set of about 2,000 different survey questions that ask Americans whether they would support or oppose change in federal government policy. And these were questions that were asked during the 1980s and 1990s and early 2000s. And for each of those, there's about 1,800 of them, each of those proposed changes in policy, we've gone in and coded whether, in fact, the policy change occurred or not within a certain time period of the time the question was asked. And so we're able to match up in that way what members of the public, or say affluent members of the public, if we're looking at only the respondents with high incomes from these surveys, we can match up what they say they want the government to do with what the government does. In addition, because we're interested in looking at the role of interest groups in shaping policy outcomes, we've also gone in for those 1,800 survey questions and coded which of a set of interest groups, the 43 arguably most powerful interest groups and industries in Washington, which of those were on the favorable or in opposition to each of those changes.
And your definition of interest groups ranges from beer distributors to the AFL-CIO.
Yes, that's right. There's a wide range of business groups, some of them prominent, some of them rather obscure, and a much smaller number but still a very diverse set of what we call mass-oriented interest groups. And those would be things like unions, AFL-CIO, and so on, but also more specific groups like the National Rifle Association or the AARP or the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
There's no easy way to observe economic elites' opinions. So you have a proxy, which is what the opinions of people at the 90th percentile of the income distribution, right?
That's right. Ben Page, my co-author on this work, and some of his colleagues are working to try to get a better sense of what the truly rich Americans want out of government. But they're very hard to find, and when you find them, it's very hard to get them to talk to you. And so they're using a variety of clever techniques. But the truth is that the data that I'm working with really does reflect, as you said, people at the 90th income percentile. That's about $146,000 in household income today.
Which is quite well off, but
they're certainly not rich by most people's definition.
Yeah, this is not the proverbial 1%.
That's right.
Your average voter is someone at the 50th percentile, right?
Yes, that's right.
Which corresponds with what's sometimes called in literature the median voter.
Yes. We're using the median income respondent, so people whose income falls like right in the middle of the distribution. But as we argue in this paper, those preferences are very similar to what people who've discussed for decades, this idea of the median voter, the person whose preferences lie right in the middle of the distribution and to whom it's believed the government ought to be the most responsive.
And do you have any evidence of what kind of correlation there is between the 90th and, say, 99th percentiles, or are you just hoping that there's some decent correlation?
Well, we have a little bit of data from one very large survey that did have a significant number of people, at least at the 98th percentile, so the sort of top 2% of household income in this country. And so we were able, on a small number of policy questions, to compare their views with those at the 90th or the 50th income percentiles. And they do correlate much more strongly with those at the 90th. But there's likely to be issues that are of, you know, sort of particular significance for the very rich, things like, you know, how carried interest is treated in terms of taxation, maybe some aspects of corporate regulation, where it would be surprising if we didn't see some divergence even between, the, say, the 1% and the 90th percentile that I'm looking at.
But the concerns of the 90th percentile, a lot of fiscal rectitude scores highly on their scale, right?
Yes, indeed.
I'm speaking with Martin Gillens, who is a professor of political science at Princeton. Okay, so your findings. I was surprised when I was reading the paper that if you look at each of these groups in isolation, the 50th, the 90th percentile, and the interest groups, they all separately have a fairly decent correlation with actual outcomes.
That's correct. And I think that explains why there's been decades of work that sort of promotes the idea that each of these, when you look at them individually, seems to be an important player in shaping policy.
But then when you look at them together, the picture changes.
It does indeed. It changes quite dramatically. And what we found was that the sort of middle income, the average citizen, which seemed to have preferences that were, and in fact does have preferences that are associated with policy outcomes, in fact appears to have virtually no actual influence over those outcomes. That is to say, when you take into account the preferences of other groups, of economic elites and of interest groups, then you can see that it really seems to make essentially no difference what middle-income Americans prefer. That policy outcomes are, policy is just as likely to be adopted if middle-income Americans oppose it as if they support it, once you take into account these other groups' views.
Now that sounds paradoxical. How do you reconcile those things?
Well, so part of the apparent paradox is a result of the fact that there are many issues on which middle-income Americans and the affluent or interest groups actually agree. So, for example, in my data set, looking at the wide range of questions having to do with military or defense policy, there's very little disagreement between people in the middle or the top of the income distribution. Questions about the environment, about drug policy, most educational policies. So there are many cases where middle-income Americans are, in fact, getting the policies that they want, not because they're influencing government, but because they happen to agree either with the affluent or with interest groups.
So where does the divergence appear then?
The divergence appears on economic issues that have a redistributive component. As you might expect, affluent Americans are much less enamored of progressive taxation than the middle class or the poor. There are strong divergences in the extent of support for sort of market-oriented policies. So affluent Americans tend to be quite supportive of sort of free market-type approaches, whether it's to corporate regulation, to things like Medicare HMOs or school vouchers, or trade policy. So much greater support for sort of a free trade regime among the well-off and, for the most part, among interest groups than among middle-class Americans. The third dimension there, though, which is quite interesting, is social issues like abortion and gay rights and school prayer. And on those kinds of issues, you see consistent divergences, but in the other direction politically, which is to say that the middle class tends to be more conservative on those kinds of issues than affluent Americans.
And, well, that seems to be at the core of the Republican electoral strategy, flatter the middle class on social issues and flatter the upper class on the economic ones.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And, of course, for the Democrats, it's kind of the reverse constellation of views.
You don't address this specifically, but what about, you know, these kinds of things that Rita Scherer and others have written about, this kind of new suburban professional base for Democrats, which I guess would be socially liberal but fiscally moderate? Did they show up in your data anywhere?
Yeah, to a certain extent. So one of the ways that party enters into the analysis, and here I'm talking more about other work that I've done, including in a recent book called Affluence and Influence, rather than this paper with Benjamin Page. But in that book, one of the things that that I look at is the role of the political parties in promoting the interests of different segments of the public. And so what we do see is a parallel to what you were just mentioning. That is to say, a Democratic Party that in past years was more aligned with the economic preferences of the middle class and the poor, but has adopted many of the same sort of free market policies, free market orientations, as the Republican Party has over time. And things like, again, a movement toward free trade, deregulation, of course, things like the repeal of the Glass-Steagall banking laws under Clinton. So in these kinds of areas, the Democratic Party has adopted a set of economic policies that are less consistent with what the less well-off prefer and more consistent with the interests and the preferences of the affluent, as well as having the sort of social agenda that's more consistent with what well-off Americans want.
We've been speaking of interest groups as if they're all a block, but of course there are different kinds of interest groups with different interests. What can you say about their competing interests and their relative influence?
You're quite right about that. And there's many cases where business groups have divergent views. In fact, lots of politics is really about the interests of one industry versus another, the lawyers versus the doctors on malpractice, that sort of thing. And to some degree, that's true for the more mass-oriented groups as well, where you've got pro-abortion and anti-abortion groups, competing. So there is quite a diversity there. What I expected to find but did not find was any strong relationship between the alignments of interest groups and the preferences of citizens. So what many people would have expected would be that affluent Americans would sort of line up on average more closely with what certainly business groups and maybe interest groups more broadly want than would the middle class. And yet I really did not find that. And I think one of the key reasons is that while it's true that interest groups share the affluent's preferences for low taxes, that they tend to diverge from the preferences of well-off Americans in often advocating for greater government spending. Now, of course, they're advocating for greater spending on the particular issues that they stand to benefit from. Right, so you've got a healthcare industry that wants government to be spending more on pharmaceuticals and on health insurance more generally, which is something that tends to be more beneficial and is favored more strongly by less well-off Americans. So there's an example of a sort of an alliance between the less well-off and a particular industry or set of interest groups who are, of course, not working to promote the interests of disadvantaged Americans. They're working to promote their own interests. But at the same time, those interests are consistent with the preferences and the needs of the middle class and the poor.
And you say several times in the paper in different ways, I don't have an exact quote at hand, but I'm not paraphrasing too recklessly, that the predominant influences are the preferences of the affluent and of interest groups, particularly business interest groups, and that ordinary Americans have virtually no influence on public policy. And that's a fair summary of your findings.
Yeah, no, that is very fair, and that there's only a modest influence of the sort of more mass-oriented groups, unions and the AARP and those sorts of groups.
And you conclude the paper by saying this really makes us wonder if the United States can call itself a democracy. I know you're a political scientist and a rigorous fellow, but could you muse on that a moment?
Well, sure. I mean, there's many different sort of dimensions of democracy, and I don't want to overstate our claims, but central to what most people understand democracy to mean is the widespread ability of citizens to shape the policies that their government adopts. And that is absolutely not what we find in our analyses. It just the evidence for citizens' influence over government policy is just extremely weak.
And you address this in passing, but I wonder if you have any thoughts on this as well. I mean, to what degree do the preferences of the rich and the organized influence public perceptions? I mean, so to what degree are the public opinion shaped by the interests of the upper orders? And secondarily, how important is it what is kept off the agenda as well as what's voted on?
Two good questions, and we do address them both in the paper, at least briefly. I think there is a concern that, especially in an era when the media are struggling so much financially and we're in so much turmoil, in terms of the sources of information, the kinds of information that citizens get, there is a concern that this leaves ordinary citizens more open to, let's say, manipulation by affluent interests, affluent Americans, or groups that are trying to shape their views. Now, this is a difficult thing to assess, and of course part of politics has always been efforts to shape the views or the preferences of others. But the fact that there's so little relationship between what ordinary citizens say they want government to do and what government does suggests that if these powerful groups are trying to influence the public in order to adopt the preferences and the outlooks that the groups want them to, then they're doing a very poor job of it. Because, in fact, it does not appear that ordinary citizens' views align very well with what government's doing. So I would say, as far as that first issue goes, that's an important issue in itself, but probably not one that figures very importantly in the work that we're doing. Now I'm sorry, what was the second question you asked?
How things are kept off the agenda as well as what's introduced.
The question of what's on the agenda is extremely important, and I think one of the virtues of the work that we've done is that we're not restricting our analysis to issues that are taken up by government policymakers. So there's a lot of analysis of how representatives in Congress vote, and we've learned a lot from that analysis, but one of the constraints on that is that you can only look at issues that, in fact, are on the government agenda, that are taken up by elites and considered. And we rely on surveys in part because we want to tap into a much broader agenda. We want to be able to look at what happens to possible government changes that either are taken up by policymakers and not adopted, things that might be reflected, say, in congressional voting, or changes that could have been taken up but were not taken up in the first place. So the analysis that we do is capturing both of those kinds of failures to respond to the preferences of the public, both those that are a failure as a consequence of keeping them off the agenda and those that don't match up with public preferences because they were considered but rejected.
That was Martin Gillens, a professor of political science at Princeton and co-author of a paper with Benjamin Page of Northwestern University on just who influences political decision-making in the United States. You can find the paper on Gillens' website. Just Google Gillens, G-I-L-E-N-S, and Princeton, and you should find it. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some old hippie music that goes out to the propertied who rule us. Till next week, bye.